Accession number 16059, John Court, reel 13.
Mr. Court, reel 13. Could you say anything more about the village? You know, what it was built of or anything else about it? What you remember?
Well, I can remember only the fact I think it was stone houses. I think the reason that this part of this house had collapsed, I think there was some heavy shelling going on at the same time. But
sounds almost as though you might have had a near miss.
That could have.
A medium shell that hit the front of the house.
Instead of hitting the tank itself. That could well have been. That could have well have been. It happened so quickly. I say, well, I went over the low wall, feeling very vulnerable because, you know, with no nothing at all to protect ourselves with, and the wireless operator was there as well. And eventually, a Sherman came up the road, and I can remember running to the back of it with the intention of actually climbing on the back of the tank, and the tank commander yelling, "You can't get on, we're just engaging this Panthers at the end of the street." So we promptly ran. He said, "The best thing you can do is get into one of the houses." Well, Hugh Warrow, who was my wireless operator, I said to him, "Well, I don't fancy doing that because our infantry were following us through, and well, you can't blame them. I mean, the point is they kick the door in and just spray, and I didn't fancy being in. I mean, they're going to see a movement. They're not going to say friend or foe. They just want to, take out whatever there." So I said to Huey, "I think we'll stay behind the wall," which we did. And
what was behind the wall? Were you in a yard?
In the yard, yes, yes. It was a show. But there was, the funny thing was, it was only a small wall, and there was some sniping going on, and whether they were trying to pick us off or whether it was just sheer random firing, I don't know, but there seemed an awful lot of bullets hitting the wall above us as though they were trying to ricochet it down. But, we didn't hang around too long. Once our own infantry came through, I made our way back with Huey back to the tank.
How far behind the tanks were the infantry?
Well, it was a while before they came through.
Do you remember who they were?
No, I don't. I don't. I think myself that basically they'd expected just to have infantry in the village. I don't think they thought there was going to be. Even it appeared afterwards, I was told that the guards' armour division didn't get. They met far greater opposition than they thought, and they didn't complete their circling movement. So it meant that there were some heavy armoured vehicles still in the village, and also they thought they would pull out once the armoured started moving around, but they. Obviously, they didn't. And it's funny what you said then about being an AP or even HE hitting the vehicle, hitting the house. It's something I hadn't thought about. That's quite a possibility. Yes, I hadn't thought about that. But
was the village in when you first went into it? Was it?
Well, it seemed to be all quiet. You see, there was nothing around at all. You know, it didn't seem as though we had. I mean, we thought it was just going to be an ordinary little, straightforward run into a village, with a few infantry, and no problems. You know, but we certainly come up against great more than we thought.
This was a few days after Goodwood.
After Goodwood, yes, right. Yeah. It was only 2 or 3 days after Goodwood, right. And then we came out again. And actually, I think we went on rest then for a while. It becomes very, very confused. I can't remember a great deal. It's funny little things which really have no bearing on military or anything. Is going into a farmhouse and finding bottles of Calvados. And one of the co-driver, who was supposed to be quite a hard drinking man. He said, you know, this is stuff, you know, I can drink pints of beer, you know. And so he put in, he was just showing off actually, and he drank this Kalbadozov, and within half an hour he was absolutely out. And it was rather funny because it was only about an hour after that with a sudden panic, stand to, move out, you see. And we said, my goodness, what are we going to do with him? Because he was absolutely spark out. So we picked him up, dropped him into the co-driver's seat, dropped the hatch on him, and that was rather funny because we moved up this road, and something, I suppose it was my fault, as much as anything, we'd been there for quite a while, and I'd switched the main engine off, and hadn't thought, and they'd been using, perhaps the batteries wasn't up to much, but anyway, they'd been using the radio quite a lot, and it's been there a few hours, and eventually they decided to pull us back out of it, and someone said start up, and then suddenly an AP came whistling down the road, and it was all panic, and I remember the commander saying start up driver, and I pressed the button and it just went chonk. I thought, God, no. You know, the last place out there, you know, you feel so exposed out on the road. You know, it's different if you're in a wood. But anyway, they started a haul again, and it sun charged up a bit enough to get me going, and I picked up and we moved out. But the funny thing was we moved back to the same position we'd moved it before we'd gone off, you see. We dragged the chappie out of the co-driver's seat, propped him against the tank, and a couple of hours later he came round, and he hadn't got the foggiest idea, and I said to him, do you realise you've been in action? And he was most indignant. He said, bloody hell, he said, supposing the tank had been hit. I said, hard luck, chum. But no, it's one of those things.
What was he supposed to actually do? Was he concerned primarily with manning the whole machine gun? Yes.
I didn't personally. I mean, I always felt a co-driver was a waste, because if the tank is that much, badly hit, that the driver is knocked out. Unless he's, I mean, there is a possibility of okay, you could have he could have his head out and he could get sniped, or he'd have shrapnel or something like that. In case okay, the co-driver to take over, but. Other than that, I always felt that the co-driver was a waste. He really was.
What about relieving the driver?
Pardon?
Did the co-driver ever actually relieve the driver?
No. This is something that, I mean, all the time I had a co-driver, my co-driver never relieved me at any time. But then it went the opposite way, which, again, is psychological, I suppose, is the fact that some person had the bright idea that they'd do away with the co-driver's seat, weld up the escape hatch, and put a extra ammunition rack there, 75 ammunition rack. Well, again, I suppose if a shell came through and hit the tank that bad, it's goodbye anyway, but I suppose it's the actual feeling that you've got a load of ammunition beside you. And the other aspect was that if the gun was traversed a little bit off of centre over your hatchway, you've got no escape that way. And afterwards, they redesigned it. Well, I say redesigned turret. A lot of the turrets didn't have that cutaway section, so you couldn't get back in the turret. If the gun was over, the gun mantle came over, you couldn't open your own hatch, so you're stuck.
You'll be trapped.
And that was, it's there in your mind all the time that if we're hit, I can't get out. And that gets to you.
You're mentioning the chap taking Kalbadozov. Did you manage to get any local food?
Cheese? Yes, we used to have the cheese. None of us could decide whether or not, the you know, that crinkly hard bit on the soft cheese and on the crinkly. We could never decide whether or not we should eat that or not. Some would eat it and others would say no, and they used to cut it off with their knife and eat just the soft centre with the biscuits. Now that was... And also the farm animals, you know, with all the cows in the fields being killed, and having to bring up they had some Shermans with bulldozer fronts, and they used to dig out holes and just fill them in, or just push the soil over them, because at that particular time we were having a very good summer, and the poor old cows used to blow up, and of course when they try to push the soil onto them, they used to burst, and you could smell them a mile away. But though I used to feel, strange enough, again, it's my funny way of thinking, I suppose, but I would see infantry and our own people dead. It didn't affect me a great deal, but if I saw, as there were, you know, in France, they tend to tether the horses around the roof, around the hoof, with a short, say 4 or 5 foot length of rope, with a stake in the ground, and we go into a field, perhaps where there'd be 2 or 3 horses, and they'd start mortaring, and the poor horses used to be trying to tug away from the, and that I used to feel that more than anything, you know, to see horses with shrapnel wounds in them. I used to feel that they never knew what was happening, whereas infantrymen or people knew, so therefore they could get out of trouble. I don't know. Just trying to think of any other actions that.
The next big action for the division was Bluecoat.
Bluecoat.
That was in August.
No, I'd left by then.
You'd left by then?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, what happened was, after Goodwood, we were at a village. Again, it's something I often wonder whether or not it's because you become. I mean, I know that we lost a terrific amount of NCOs. I believe at one time all our senior NCOs were either wounded or killed. And I was, as I say, from Aldershot, I was just a Lance Corporal. And then we were in this village and we were walking around looking at different things, and I went into this house and I saw this beautiful piece of green material, and I thought, God, that's just the regimental the squadron colours, green, you see. So what did I do? I made myself a good neckerchief of it, you see, and tucked it around and tucked it into my blouse, and I'm walking down the road and the squadron leader came past and he said, "What the devil do you think you're, no, what army do you think you're in, Court?" I said, I thought it looked a bit flamboyant, sir. So he said, "Yes, I suppose it does." And that was it. And next day on squadron orders, it got, I'd been made up to full corporal. And I always think it was because, it was either that or because they'd run out of NCOs, I don't know. But anyway, that was that. And then.
Did that make much difference?
No, I don't think so.
Still doing the same kind of work.
Same work, yeah. I was still driving, you know. I know that there was, what I did think, or was hoping at some time, that one time, or if they run short of tank commands, they might. Although, you see, you can't take a driver and make him a tank commander. There's no way he can get by, but. I wouldn't have that knowledge of, all right, I'd be able to put a tank hull down, or I'd use my common sense, and certainly, you know, perhaps if it was a case of flanking another tank, I don't know. I'd take advantage of the ground. I did have that sort of knowledge of tank warfare, but I think there's a bit more to it than that, and I don't think that, in respect to the crew, I don't think I felt I would have been able to take over with the ability to give them that which I should be able to as a tank commander. I don't know, in a situation where I had to take over, of course I would have done. I mean, that was it. Anything to get out of trouble. But anyway, that never came about because Falaise, the Battle of Falaise had started, and we'd been having a lot of movement about, and I think that particular, I know everybody was nearly asleep on, they were using searchlights then to keep, you know, sort of artificial daylight, and I know everybody was virtually out on their feet, and I was so tired, and I think I was guard commander, and I was going around the tanks waking them up every 5 minutes, it seemed to me. And anyway, I got, that particular morning, I got back in the tank in the driver's compartment. If, again, I'm not quite sure, but I remember them saying that start-up driver. And I thought, who's he talking to? Not talking to me. Who's he talking to? And there was a terrific bang. I think either a mortar or something, a shell had dropped beside the tank. And again, and I heard this voice say again, come on, start up, driver. And I thought, he's talking to somebody. I don't know who he's talking to. And I don't remember anymore. I don't remember anymore. The next thing I remember, I'm in a British ambulance. I'm going along, and the orderly in the ambulance was saying to me, hold on to this. And I was holding on to a blood container, and there was an officer, an infantry officer, with half his arm blown away. And I can remember him saying, this has buggered up my game of golf. And I shall always remember that. And they took me back to a British medical aid centre.
Was that the regimental post or something beyond?
I don't know. I just don't know. And they whipped me out of there and put me into an American ambulance and took me back to St. Lo in the Second General American Hospital.
What happened to you there?
Well, they used to have a system there where they used to have nurses at night and then women nurses at night, and in the daytime they used to have a sequence of there used to be a captain and a major used to come round, an officer. They used to take it in turns, and they used to just examine you. And I can remember this this major said, well, if you were one of our fellows, he said, we'd send you back to the States. But I can remember also thinking about, what the hell am I doing here? There's nothing wrong with me. What am I here for? And I remember the efficiency of the, that's again is something which I remember, the efficiency of the Americans. They, you know, with us, we would dig a trench and put a pole across it, and that would be our latrines. Not those boys. They'd come along with a machine on the back of a lorry. They'd drill six holes. Another lorry would come in, drop a concrete block on top of it, the holes all matching the holes in the ground. They'd fit latrines, proper pans on, another long, along with a tent, and electricity run through to it, complete latrine with lights and everything. Fantastic. But as I say, I just couldn't puzzle out, and I was there a fortnight. And eventually they came and they said, again, this officer said to me, well, he said, I'm afraid, he said, that I've got nothing to do, he said, except to send you back to a British hospital. But he said, if you're one of our boys, he said, we think you've had enough, we'd send you back to the States. But anyway, they gave me a piece of paper. It said, in our considered opinion, this man is no longer fit for active duty.
Did he give a reason why?
Oh, they put some long names underneath. I can't remember now. But I suppose basically they said I was shell-shocked, but I couldn't see it. Inwardly I was thinking to myself, what the hell? There's nothing wrong with me. You know, what are they? But anyway, they shipped me to...
Did they give you any treatment at this hospital?
No, nothing at all.
They just examined you once.
That's right, yes. That's right. In fact, I used to feel sorry, because not far from the hospital at St. Lo, actually the hospital at St. Lo was filled with American soldiers. I was the only British there. And they used to fill it with, it was filled with American soldiers who had been caught in their own bombing at St. Lo. And just outside of St. Lo, about 3 or 4 miles outside of St. Lo, was a fighter, American fighter base. And the pilots were going around with a lot of the nurses from the hospital. And they used to beat up the hospital. They used to come over really low. And all the patients, and a terrific amount of colour, they would all be diving out of bed and running across the fields, bomb happy, if you like. You know, I used to feel sorry for them. I used to think, poor devils, you know. And I remember saying to one of these nurses, I said, why the devil do these people keep flying so low? He said, well, we have spoken to them, but, you know, they like to show off. But I thought it was terrible to the fact that, you know, that they were just showing off to the nurses. But there you are.
Did you get to know any of the American patients who are in there?
No, I got to know one of the nurses.
You did?
Her name, Miss Marion Keegan, 286 North May Street, Chicago, Illinois. I've often wondered what happened to her. She sent me a parcel years afterwards, when I was up in Minden. Yeah, it's she was great. She used to sit on the bed at night time and talk to me, and I couldn't sleep. And she used to talk and talk and talk. I learned more about Chicago and America than I'd ever known before, but she was great. But anyway, they transferred me there to Main British Hospital at Bayeux. And the matron there was a dragon. My God, she was a dragon. It was in a farm, big farm courtyard, and they used to have two. The American way of food. After I'd been there about a week, they allowed me up, and they had three dustbins. They had a big rack, and on the rack was your utensils, knife, fork, and spoon, and a tray was in segments, and you'd pick your knife and fork and spoon up. Then you go to the first dustbin, and under each one of these dustbins was like a burner. And the first one was disinfectant. You dipped it in that and took it out. You dipped it into the second one and dipped it in the last one, which was clean water, took it out, and then walked along and got your food. And when you came out...
This was the American system.
American system. And then when you came out the other end, you did the same thing. Clean, disinfectant, and hung your things up, which was fantastic. Well, then I went to the British Hospital at Bayeux, and we had two long baths, about 6 foot long, and you swilled your mess tins in one, and then you smelled it in the other. Well, after about 200 men had gone through it was just like swilling it in soup. And as I say, the dragon of a matron she was. You had to fold. They supplied me with a complete outfit of clothes, Americans. I had... the only thing I had left, actually, of my own was, I don't know what happened to my battle dress, but they supplied me with their own, because it was all fine material. I had a coat, trousers. I think the only thing I had left was my BlackBerry. I think everything else was theirs. And they couldn't do enough. It was absolutely fantastic. But when this matron, she said, what arm are you in? So I explained to her. She said, you can't walk around in that, she said. But she insisted everything had to be folded and put folded neatly at the side of your bed, you know. And I thought, even more so, I began to feel, well, what is, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. Let me get out of this lot. So I got out of there and went up to our tank delivery squadron just outside of Bayeux. And... they told me there was a tank going up to the third. It was a corporal. Can't think of his name now. Corporal in was taking the tank up, and we just had a driver. So there was just the three of us. And it was automatic honey. And I did take over from this young driver a few times because I found it very interesting to drive this automatic honey tank. I'd never driven a honey before, and it was quite interesting. But
did you get yourself discharged from the British Hospital?
Yes. Well, I couldn't see anything was anything wrong with me. You know, I mean, I felt as fit. I didn't see what they were holding me for. So anyway, I went up to remove this tank, and of course, by this time everything was moving up quite quickly. So we were picking up our petrol and food from different places. I remember we pulled into a village called Bavincourt in the Pas-de-Calais, and there was a Captain Dufresne. There was a little band, I think it was a resistance group. I think it was a pocket of Germans up in the hillside. I think, and we had to sort them out for for them. I think we dropped a couple of HE beside them, and that was it. But I remember this cat. I've got his photograph at home now. He's Captain Dufresne and his son. But it was funny because only about, just before my wife had her stroke, we were down at Dover one day, and I said, let's go over to France. And I took a car down to Bavincourt, and it was amazing. It was exactly the same. And the Lamas family, who I befriended while I was there, and the old lady who lived opposite the chateau, she remembered. I said, do you remember the tank against the wall? She said, oh, yes, I remember. It was marvellous to go back. But the village itself, apart from a little porter cabin thing in the playground of the school, it was exactly the same. Hadn't altered at all. It was marvellous going back.
But where did you actually manage to catch up with the regiment?
I'm sorry, I deviated. We went through, and then we were up in Holland, and I remember we were going along a road, dead straight road, and I remember there were tanks on the side of the road, and as we went past up this road, they just waved to us, and we carried on up, and I can't remember this corporal's name. He said to me, it was still a honey, yes. Oh, it's a honey tank.
Were you on your way to the third?
Yes, trying to catch up with the third, you see. Yes, rejoin them.
So you're travelling on your own?
Absolutely. That's right. That's right, yes. And we were travelling up this road. Anyway, we ran into this village. And it was funny because this corporal said to me, he said, I don't know. And it was so quiet. There wasn't a sound. There was nobody walking around, I noticed all the signs were in German, you see. So I said, I don't like the sound of this. Anyway, we went round up the street and then up, and there was a bridge, and it was blown. And I remember climbing out, walking to the front of this this bridge where it was blown. I thought, well, I don't know, we can't go this way. So I called to this. I started walking back to the tank, and I called up to this corporal, if I know, Clark, I think his name was. And I said, well, we can't go this way. And they opened up from the other side. And everything was bouncing along the road. I just ran. And this young driver, give him his due, he was good. He swung that tank round. I was hanging on the front of the tank like grim death. And he belted down the road. Anyway, we got back down where these tanks were either side of the road. And, of course, went over there and blew them up. And said, what the hell do you think you're doing? He said, well, we thought you were reconnaissance. He said, we never go up there. He said, they come back over. He said, at night time, he said, they take this side of the village over again. He said, we haven't got that far yet. So we were able to tell him exactly what was up there.
You've gone beyond the front line.
That's right. Yeah, without knowing it. So anyway, we pulled.
Do you know who these tanks were?
They were Shermans.
Yes, but do you know which regiment they were?
No, I don't. I can't remember. No.
They were British.
Oh, yes, they were British tanks. Yes, yes. Yeah. But, so we came out of there, and then we went, we came round, I don't know how it came about, I know we carried on up through, and we finished, actually we pulled into Antwerp, and Antwerp hadn't been taken, and we pulled out of Antwerp, because there was still a lot going on there, and I forget how it was, I think this corporal said, we've come up too far north, we've got to go back down. So we went back down to Brussels, pulled into Brussels, and we were out of fuel. So we parked right beside the Aviators Memorial at Antwerp, and we jumped down, and of course all the local people were coming around us. And so the young driver, he went off with a family, and this corporal said, well, look, we can't do anything until tomorrow morning. He said, I'll sit down here. So anyway, he went off, and I was by the time I thought to myself, well, one of us got to look after the tank. So I pulled the bedding roll off the back of the tank, and suddenly his voice in perfect English said, what are you doing? And turned around, there's this young woman. So I said, well, I'm going to get... Oh, she said, you're liberators, you can't So I said, well, yes, I can. She said, no, you've got to come home, she said. And she said, just a moment. Off she went, and she come back with a local police, Bobby, and she said, look after the tank while we've gone. So anyway, I went to a home, and they made me very welcome, a very nice family. Obviously somebody of they had servants, and her name was Madame Noelgsy Kirchhove de Ossingham. And I remember she wrote to me once, when I rejoined the regiment, and it had this big crest on the envelope. Her husband was something to do with big shipping in Antwerp, but the family made me really welcome. They really did. It was marvellous. And I wish we'd have kept in contact, but I didn't. You know, like everything with the war years. But I often wonder what happened to her and the family. But anyway, we left there and went on up to and found the regiment. And this is something I can't understand. They arrived back at the squadron office. I gave them the papers which they'd given from the British hospital and the American hospital. And I don't know who the officer was, but he said to me, what you're saying, he said, is the fact you're not going back into tanks. So I said, no, I'm not saying that at all. I said, but what I do, I think the actual fact, this, the do on the, when I belted and got on the front of the tank, that shook me up a bit, I think. Anyway, when I got back,